And the question is, for all you mid-round VCs listening in, you know, if all of the noise about, okay, startups can need $1 to $3 million and then fund themselves out of customer revenue and still achieve like venture scale outcomes, if that's true, like what happens to the middle part of venture is a really interesting question.
I love this question. Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have Peter Walker, as head of insights from Carta, a man who needs no introduction, but I will allow him to graciously give his own introduction on the Ignite podcast. Welcome to the program.
That is completely untrue, Brian. But yeah, happy to be here. As you mentioned, I'm Peter and I run the insights team at Carta. And Carta is a cap table management platform. We have about 43,000 startups on the platform right now. So that sort of level of access gives us this wonderful data set on which to build aggregated and anonymized trends about what's going on across the startup ecosystem, in particular here in the US. So happy to be here.
Yeah. And I'd love to just kind of, you know, I usually start like take this almost chronologically. I'd like to start with like kind of the genesis of you getting into this space and how you ended up at Carta and interested in venture capital.
Yeah. So I've only really worked at small startups for the vast majority of my career. You know, I did, I started a company in college and then ended up jumping around to small startups in the early part of my days after school. And then during the pandemic, I actually ran the data visualization team for the COVID tracking project, which was actually housed in the Atlantic magazine.
Oh, wow. So that was yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was
I mean, really well done.
Thank you. I mean, absolutely wild experience, like 200 or 300 people in a Slack channel. You'd never met any of them. It's completely, you know, everyone's at home and pretty scared there in April or May 2020. And it was this kind of PhD in putting out data at scale and getting a ton of feedback, good and bad. As you can imagine, my DMs were kind of a mess for that year. But that it gave me this idea that, you know, there are a lot of data sets across B2B SaaS, where I'd been spending a lot of my time in early startups, that have this level of interest. And so I wrote down a few companies that I thought would be fantastic and would have this level of data that I could help bring to the public. And Carta was like obviously top of that list. So got introduced to the CMO here and badgered her for a job for a little while. And so that's how I got in. I was like, I was looking for a data set to do this with, and Carta just happened to be the best place to be.
Yeah. I mean, what a privileged company to be at if you're interested in having, you know, first party primary research data for the venture community. I mean, Carta has more than anybody probably.
Yeah, I feel pretty lucky.
So tell us about like, why did venture capital go to hell in a handbasket in 2022? Like what happened? What are some of, you know, like obviously we had this hangover from 21. We had all time highs. I mean, I saw it as an investor. We had rounds that are 100x, 200x, 300x, and we still have some of that in AI right now. So yeah, what happened and why did things just go kind of so cold?
I mean, it's a confluence of a lot of things. I think people would point first and foremost to interest rates changing. You know, cost of money kind of flows to the entire rest of the economy, and startups are no exception there. As risk capital gets a lot more risky, if you can make 5% in a savings account, you know, a lot of funding will go into less risky assets at that point. And startups are basically as risky an asset as you can invest into on an individual basis. So that's number one.
Is there any riskier asset class than startups, I wonder?
I mean... No idea. Like, I guess perhaps international startups, if we were
international to startups in like, developing countries.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
I'd probably be the only. Yeah.
But I'm with you. Like, this is it. You know,
this people, is it. Founders, this is as risky as it gets.
Founders are taking real risks here. So, I mean, respect to those people. The other thing that happened, as you mentioned, like, there to me, there's never not a bubble in startups. It just happens to be like which bubble you are. You're either on the back or the front end of a bubble.
And it's either, expanding into a bubble or bursting.
Or like slowly popping.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So, and we had the crypto bubble, and that was everybody's favorite thing for a while. And now we have the AI bubble. And AI, I mean, speaking personally, I think AI is a lot more real than crypto for a lot of different use cases.
Yeah.
But it's there's no doubt that some of the 100 or 200x multiples that you're seeing as an investor right now, like the possibility of a lot of those companies panning out is still relatively slim. Like, so we're a little bit more realistic across the ecosystem right now, but there's always pockets of craziness.
Yeah. And, you know, what are you kind of seeing now that we're almost a full quarter into, you know, 2024? I've definitely felt it as an investor, you know, as I go out and, you know, make investments and, you know, what my LPs are saying and things like that. But I would love to get some data behind my hunches here as somebody who looks at the data all the time.
All the time. I think we've started 2024 on a slightly more positive note than the majority of 2023. If I had to guess, 2023 is going to be the low point for invested capital into Carta startups for quite a while. Now, if you just look at it on a relative basis, you know, like in Q4 21, something like $65, $66 billion went to Carta startups. That's a wild quarter.
Yeah.
Versus 12 or 13 billion in Q4 of 23. So that's an 80% drop.
75-80% decrease year over year. Wow.
Wild.
Wow.
And so that's, you know, that's 21 to 23. Q4 or Q1 24, I think, is going to be better. And so I think we're on this slow climb to a more normal state. The difference of right now, though, is that it's much more than in 2020 or 2021 when it felt like the climb was basically everyone, like everyone was up and to the right. Right now, I think there's going to be, at the same exact moment, you can read through TechCrunch and there'll be a big headline about some gigantic AI round. And then the next thing will be a late stage startup that you're familiar with shutting down. So it's like a very dichotomous, bipolar sort of feeling at the moment.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And it was interesting as an investor to kind of see, you know, definitely the valuations get compressed, you know, especially from 2021, where, you know, I saw pre-revenue, pre-launch startups with a few engineers, you know, raising at 50 caps.
Yeah.
You know,
wild.
You're like, well, what is going on? You know, and you have no revenue, you have barely a product.
Right.
To, you know, getting into companies that, you know, have 500K of ARR for a 5 to 10 cap. You know, so these very reasonable pre-seed, seed, 10 to 20X kind of valuations, at least in B2B SaaS. Is that kind of what you're seeing in the data as well?
Yeah, I think this is actually a place where Carta data is, not to toot our own horn, but maybe even better than the other data sets out there, just because we have access to safes and convertible notes in a way that more priced round focused databases don't have. Mm-hmm. So across the safe landscape, we've seen kind of two things happen. One, a lot of funding is happening through safes rather than priced equity at the pre-seed and even seed round stage now. So like safes are just the flavor du jour, the right instrument to take in early capital. And then two, as you said, the valuation cap, you know, explicitly in the safe, the reason to use it, or one of the stated reasons to use it, is that you're not actually deciding on the valuation. You're waiting for the future price round investor to do so. But valuation caps sort of function as this valuation idea for these early rounds.
And
yeah, it's a proxy.
Yeah.
It's weird because it's not a specific valuation. It's always that round number. It's like 8 or 9 or 10. So it's a little strange. But
then you got discounts and you got all kinds of other like little things.
Like, there's a lot of different ways to flavors to saves. But in general, what we're seeing is, like you said, you know, companies when the pre-seed stage, which, you know, raising 500 to a million, it's about a $8 to $10 million valuation cap. Pretty reasonable. And the quality of those companies, I think, is what has really changed. Mm. When we talk to a lot of investors in the ecosystem, they say, as you mentioned, yes, we're no longer getting pitches with decks and nothing else. We're getting pitches from companies that have real ARR, actual customer lifts, and are actively improving and iterating on the product, even at that early stage.
Yeah. I'd love to dive in. Do you guys keep track of any of the terms that are changing kind of in these pre-seed and seed rounds? Because, you know, back in 21, you might underwrite a safe with a no discount, no side letters, very plain vanilla YC safe.
Yep.
And now you're starting to run into, I'm seeing, you know, 1 and 2X lick prefs, all kinds of weird warrant terms. Like, are you guys tracking kind of these garlands?
You're running into lick prefs on the safe docs. Oof.
Not necessarily, but I'm just throwing out terms. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I was like, damn, that's a weird term.
Yeah, that'd be a weird term.
Yeah, totally. We can dig into all sorts of interesting stuff on the deal terms. So maybe starting on the safe side. You know, standard terms on the safe, valuation cap and discount across Carta in tens of thousands of safes that were signed in 2023. Most, about 90% of them have a valuation cap, and then about 33% of them have a discount. 30 to 40% have a discount. So the vast majority come with a val cap. A lot have a discount as well.
I've actually seen a kind of a move away from discounts. Is that kind of fleshed out in the data as well, corroborated by the data?
It is.
It feels like 3 or 4 years ago, even during the kind of the bubble, a 20% discount was very standard. And now I get a lot of pushback on discounts for some reason.
So discounts, when they are showing up in the data, 20% is still the standard rate.
Yeah.
And it, one, basic, like, that's 70% of the safes that have a discount have a 20% discount, which means no one's negotiating it. It's just, right. Hey, let's just use 20.
Here's but what it is.
Point, yeah. I find it kind of odd that discounts are going away. It would seem like in a more investor, quote unquote, investor friendly environment, that would be some a portion of the safe negotiation that comes back.
Right.
I've also found it weird. Like, you know, the safe, people have a lot of different opinions about the safe. The other point that I wanted to make on the terms is that the safes that we're seeing on the platform are more and more of them are coming with a side letter that entails some sort of kind of quasi priced round rights for the biggest investor in that safe round. Things like pro rata, MFN, information rights on the cap table. Those are more common in side letter safe rounds now. And it's sort of like, basically people are just saying, how close can we get to a price round in terms of the rights without doing the price round legal stuff?
Yeah. And I've been on the wrong end of not having MFN in a conversion. I'm like, oh, I should ask for MFN. I didn't know he was giving MFN.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, like, wait, hold on. I could have had
MFN. I converted at a 10, but these other five investors got 6.5 or whatever.
Rough. Yeah.
Because they had the MFN. I was like, I should have asked for that.
Yeah.
Come on. Right.
It's the interesting other parts on the safes is that, well, two points. One, as I said, people are doing safes, bigger safe rounds earlier on, and also multiple safe rounds.
Yeah.
So it used to be that you would do a safe and then you'd get to price. And now it's like safe for an angel round and then raise the val cap and safe for a pre-seed and then maybe even three different valuation cap safes. And that gets really tricky on the conversion. I don't know if founders always track how much of the company they're actually giving up there. That can get really tricky.
And I'm definitely seeing that too in my port codes is, you know, three or four rounds of safes.
Yes.
You know, for 3 or 4 years before they get to an A. And maybe that's why the valuation cap discount has become less important, because it used to be, hey, if we convert and we don't hit the cap, like we converted a lower cap, then you get the discount. But like now it's so far away that by the time you do a priced round, it's going to be probably 30 or 40 million if you even get to that stage of that Series A price.
So that's the key. Like, will you get to that stage? I think that sometimes founders don't realize it's not necessarily like they kind of get, and there's great calculators on Carta to show them, hey, here's how much of the company you're actually selling in each of these safe rounds, especially if they're post money, it's a lot easier to understand.
Yeah.
But what that does is if you're guaranteeing set percentage slices of pie to those early safe investors, it means whoever's investing in your first price round has to raise the valuation so that they can get the allocation that they need in your business.
Yeah.
And that can be, so it's like you might have a perfectly reasonable business, but you've raised three safe rounds and your company is worth 15 million. But in order to make the fund economics work for the first price investor, the val really needs to be 20 million or 25.
Wow. I think you're unpacking something really super interesting, which is maybe it's safe that I actually have extended out the priced round A or seed.
Exactly. I think that is 100% happening. And it means that the price round seed and A can only fall so far. There's a floor underneath it because of all the safe activity. And a lot of that comes from the ownership requirements by the funds that are investing at seed and A.
Right. Because I was looking at some of your research and it's so well done. And everyone go out to Twitter and check it out, or X, whatever you want to call it.
Or LinkedIn, if you want to slightly LinkedIn. More paid, like calm experience. Yeah.
You know, and it looks like, the priced seed and A rounds, these investors are typically looking for 20% of the round, because they want to, they know if this is a successful breakout company, that 20% is going to get whittled away to, 10 or even 5% by the time they go IPO or get acquired. So.
Exactly. And that's the dynamic that founders, I think, need to understand. It's not that safes are good or bad. It's just that they don't change the dynamics around a valuation conversation. They just put it off. So you're going to have that conversation about valuation at some point. And so maybe my guess is that maybe price rounds or perhaps convertible notes make a slight little comeback in 24 as people kind of get familiar with, ooh, this actually has a little bit of downsides, but safes are the default instrument, and that's not going to change for a while.
Yeah. Now, I'm a student of history, and I was actually a history major before I switched to finance.
Myself as well.
Oh, nice.
Poli-sci in history. So. Oh.
Nice. I got up to the senior year of college in history, where I'm reading correspondence between famous figures and some not so famous figures.
Right.
And I'm like, this is pretty boring. So I switched to finance.
letters from old people that I don't care.
Yeah. Letters between old people in the 1700s. Okay. Yeah. Maybe I chose wrong. But You know, if you kind of take a look at 2023, what years in history does it feel like? You know, so is it like a 2010 or is it like a 2002 or 3-4? Like,
yeah, this is a question I get a lot. And unfortunately, just relying on Carta data doesn't give us a lot of historical context because the company was founded in 2013. So not as much there. If I'm looking back just broadly, I don't think that this is akin to the dot-com bubble. One, because just venture capital as an asset class is so much more well ensconced in the like whole ecosystem and economy than it was in 2000. So I think that's a big difference. Yeah. I think it's kind of more like the great financial crisis. The only difference is like when venture has been a big deal, there's never been an interest rate change like this. This is the biggest interest rate change that we've ever gone through with venture being a mature asset class. So I do think that is messing with people's heads. And it's kind of putting off, like, everyone wants to know, when are we going to get back to normal? I'm not sure that like back to normal is going to happen at one moment. Like, it's just going to be a slow mini chunking. And as I said, some companies aren't going to be able to make the switch and they're going to have to shut down, or there's just going to be a lot of messiness.
Yeah. And we seem to kind of run in 7 to 12 year cycles anyway, right? So if you kind of look at early 90s, early 2000s.
Yes.
Early 2000s to 2009, 10. You know, these are 7 to 12 year, call it 8 to 10 year kind of cycles. So, So if you look at the last peak, you know, 2021, you know, you're probably looking at late 2020s for another peak. You know, it could be earlier, could be later, but it's, you know, it's going to take years to kind of climb out of the hole.
And the question is, for all you mid round VCs listening in, you know, if all of the noise about, okay, startups can need $1 to $3 million and then fund themselves out of customer revenue and still achieve like venture scale outcomes, if that's true, like what happens to the middle part of venture is a really interesting question.
I love this question.
I have a little bit of skepticism as to whether or not you actually can achieve venture scale outcomes without venture capital for the majority of cases. But even if it's only a little bit true, it really changes the dynamics for mid-round venture.
You're talking Series B and C kind of investors.
If you don't need a $25 million capital injection because you're growing super fast, like if you're mid-journey, if there are more mid-journeys than not, how do we...
Right. Opus.
Where does that capital go?
Yeah, I just saw Opus, which does our podcast clips. So if you watch our podcast clips, it's Opus AI. I recommend that company. I won't say exactly what revenue. I'm sure it's private, but... I was like, wow, pretty significant revenue per employee. Yeah. And I think the point you're making is something I'd love to drill into and kind of opine on, which is, what is that kind of 5 to 10 year future of mid-stage VC? Like, I know as an early stage pre-seed and seed investor, it's a feeding frenzy out there. There's tons of startups that need tons of capital. They have more traction than ever. Yep. They're getting default alive quicker than ever. They're scaling infinitely with AI and software tools, and I'm seeing companies with 2 or 3 founders and a million of ARR, no employees. And, you know, Sam Altman, there's been headlines about he has this, internal kind of betting circle of like the first Fortune 500 company will be with like a single employee, like the single founder.
Was the bet for him that there would be $1 billion valued company or $1 billion ARR company? Because those are like two vastly different things,
right? But either way, I mean, just to have that discussion is absolutely incredible, right? To be in a world where AI is accelerating so fast, and maybe it kind of inverts for venture capital, I think is what the underlying point you're making there, which is maybe you don't need these big Series B, C, and D rounds anymore, because companies can now start infinitely scaling with AI, and it kind of hollows out venture capital in a way, or kind of pushes it down into the pre-seed and seed,
pushes it down, but it also means it effectively, unless you're going to do the most spray and pray strategy of all time, it effectively limits fund size as well. If your check is 500K to a million, you can't be $1 billion fund and expect to have enough viable companies. Like, it just doesn't.
Bingo.
I don't think the math works.
Bingo. So it's almost like a return to the venture roots of this cottage industry that we were.
Yep.
Maybe the peak venture, maybe 2021 will go down as peak venture of all time, perhaps. Right? Because that was kind of peak everything. And, maybe venture, I don't know, like I'm sort of bullish that, you know, there's more startups in the future, not fewer. I do feel there's more entrepreneurship, and I feel like AI is an accelerant to that.
Yes.
That generates more software and enables teams to do more than ever, right? Yeah. And I see that in my portfolio companies in the pitch decks that I see Definitely. Coming. But it's a really interesting thought experiment to think like, you know, what if you don't need to hire, you know, thousands of people
to get that billion point,
revenue? Yeah.
Like companies on Carta took that message to heart this year more than ever before. So if you look at, we have the other part of the Carta data set, which I love, is that we have data on sort of the employment market in startups, because we know when someone's granted equity. And yeah. when they leave, that equity grant is obviously terminated. So we know when they leave and we can track changes and all that stuff. Yeah. So if you do that on an aggregate basis, companies, the 40 or so thousand companies on Carta hired about 500,000 people in 2022, and they hired 260,000 people in 2023.
So that's like a 50% decline just overall in
giant
hiring.
Drop, right?
Yeah.
And then if you add in, okay, that's the hires. But then if you compare it to the leaves, both layoffs and voluntary leaves, that was actually 275,000 in 23. So more people left Carta startups than were hired at Carta startups last year. Wow. The first time we've ever seen the whole industry, quote unquote, shrink. And if that's, you know, if 2024 isn't a return to boom hiring, then you're really looking at a cottage industry is the right way to put it. Like startups as an industry will be smaller in terms of investment and headcount. That's a totally new paradigm.
Right. Yeah. And it bodes well. And this is what I tell my LPs is like, it's a really awesome time to be a very early stage investor.
Yes.
Again, it's never been a bigger feeding frenzy, but it's a terrible time to be that mid-stage investor, like you said.
It's really hard. Yeah.
Or even late stage, right? Because now you're, you know, like, especially if you deployed a lot of your capital in 22, 23, you know, markets are closed and you can't unlock that quick three to five X that you were hoping for in 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. The lack of ideas is like a big deal.
Yeah. Versus a pre-seed investor like me, I'm like, cool, here's a little bit of that 500K round. You're raising 500K and you have 500K of ARR. That's awesome.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Here's my money. And then they keep growing. And then, you know, AI just keeps accelerating everything and making marketing and sales. And you've seen the headlines with OpenAI and Klaviyo.
Yep.
Right, where they implemented OpenAI into their customer service workflows and saved them $40 million a year. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's happening right in front of our eyes.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time. But I do think that perhaps in addition to peak investment in 21, like peak employment in startups might have been 2022. There's a little bit of lag because the highest month of hiring was, you know, January 22 for us. But will that be the case? You know, how quickly can that 5-person team get to 10 million ARR, that kind of stuff? Like, you're hearing that a lot. Now, maybe we're just creatures of habit, and as soon as there's a boom to pick up on, like, hiring will inflate to the boom times, but maybe not. Maybe there's been a real structural change.
Yeah, I bet you could probably pull up data, or you probably already have, around kind of the employee count per, you know, million value cap or something like that. So that's another test of, you know, a tech company's ability to create value, is kind of revenue per employee. It's something like Amy Hood at Microsoft, where I worked at for years, would watch and tell the street very carefully. And, you know, half of the jobs at Microsoft were contractors to try to keep that number as high as possible. So I wonder, have you guys looked at sort of the, you know, the value cap per employee, like how that's being impacted with AI and stuff like that?
We looked at this a while back. So I don't have great numbers for you in the AI boom, but already in 22, you know, people were cutting costs and headcount pretty aggressively. So it was trending downward. The point that, you know, 22 was a weird year for people who had just joined startups. I think one of the other findings from the recent report was that something like, I'm just pulling it up right now, but like so if you take each cohorted year and say, okay, you are a 2021 hire, a 2022 hire, et cetera, 23% of the people that were hired in 2022 did not make it to their first year anniversary at that company.
Wow.
That's the highest. The historical averages are more like 15. So from 15 to 23, it's the highest year that we've seen. And 2023 might actually be higher. Obviously, we don't know to the full end of 24 exactly what the full year is. But so many people... Like there were so many junior and less tenured employees that left their companies, a lot of it by layoff last year. And I think that that's probably not going to get replaced. Like, we don't have, you know, we're not seeing backfills come up to the level of departures.
Yeah. And I think another trend anecdotally that I'm seeing, and I don't know if you guys have data on it, but I definitely feel it, is the kind of the rise of fractional work. You know, I talked to lots of people. You know, Team Ignite, of course, is this big network of LPs, thousands of people that help ignite startups. So I talked to a lot of these mentors and advisors and LPs on Team Ignite. And anecdotally, they'll just tell me, like, I don't want to go back and, like, be an exec at, you know, some big tech company. You know, I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good.
Just take some fractional roles and live in Idaho and fly fish and stuff like that.
Right. I'll do some consulting. Like,
yeah. And I feel like everybody's kind of reoriented. And so, like, there's almost like this, like, I don't know, this dumbbell shape to the way I perceive it, which is like you have all these early stage startups doing all this really cool stuff and lots of fundings. And I'd love to dive into that data.
Sure.
And then this hollowing out of the middle that we were just talking about. And then on the other side, you still have these huge, massive tech companies. And yet we have very low unemployment. You know, our inflation's still relatively high.
Right.
And people just have reoriented their lives. And it almost feels like we're entering kind of like this weird proxy for post-capitalist society or something where, you know, like everybody's just like, I'm just good. I'm just going to go, like, go live and, you know, on a farm and work 20 hours a week on Upwork or Fiverr and just call it good. And
And so the AI is so good that Upwork and Fiverr goes away. So that's like, I don't know. There's questions there. I'm with you.
I hire people on Upwork too. And so they're doing screen captures and screen records of all the tasks. So they have lots of data of people working on stuff.
100%.
Yeah.
It's a wild time. It really does feel as though the shift in 22 and then all obviously the release of ChatGPT in November is like, it marks an end of an era in tech startups. Mm-hmm. And like, this is the new era. And it's really hard to say exactly what that new era is going to be defined by, but it does feel qualitatively different.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. But back to kind of pre-seed seed fundings, like what are you guys seeing in the data on that?
Yeah. So pre-seed was just slightly down year over year. Seed was down, but definitely doing better than the rest of the venture ecosystem. So I think it's a truism to say the further away you are from IPO, the better the fundraising environment is at the moment.
Yep.
We're also seeing that, like, on just to put some raw numbers to the valuations and things, you know, seed rounds on Carta, those are priced seed rounds. The median valuation for a US seed round in Q4 of last year was $13.3 million. So pretty robust.
Yeah.
You add that to the $3 million or so that a company might raise, it's about $16 million on a post-money basis for a primary stage valuation. Yeah. Seems pretty reasonable. It's actually quite close to where that was in 21. Just like hasn't fallen. Now, obviously, inflation, the cost of money, all that kind of stuff is different. But on just like a raw number basis, it's pretty close to where it was at the peak. Series A, more decline in 23, but a faster pickup. So Series A is back up to about $44 million on a pre-money. So
it's almost like a, you know, like when you whip a rope.
Yes.
And it kind of takes time to kind of travel down.
Yes.
Like like venture funding, the stages are kind of like that rope, right? It's just kind of going, and then
that's a perfect analogy. If then you also say that, like, someone sort of stops the rope at some point because it, like, the early stage just can't go that low. It's like, no, that's enough. That's enough pain. For that. Whereas the later stages, like, you know, the valuations and fundraising.
Yeah, the beta is very high at the late stage.
Yes.
Right? The market goes down 20-30%. Those late stage valuations are probably 2x beta. It's going down 2x more than the market.
I would agree with that. And it takes a little bit of lag. So in general, I think the early stage in startups is actually pretty healthy right now. Valuations are decent. Round sizes are decent. You've got the messiness with safes, which makes this a kind of a difficult thing to track. But the other point is that when we track dilution, so like how much ownership are founders giving up at these stages, it's relatively flat. You know, the old rule of thumb of 20% for a seed and 20% for an A seems to be holding pretty steady. So it's not as though investors are demanding much, or receiving, I should say, they may be demanding it, much higher ownership percentage than they used to. Some of that may be just in the rights and terms of the deals have changed a little bit, but by and large, I think it's still a decently healthy market there.
Yeah. And what do you see in the pre-seed? Is it typically like a 10%?
Yeah. So it depends on the size of the pre-seed. If you're doing an angel round, which we would define as anything less than, call it you know, it's called $300,000 to $400,000. You're probably only selling, I'm pulling this data up right now, but you're probably only selling between like 5% and 6% of your business.
Yeah. These are typically angels and friends and family and folks like that. So
exactly.
Giving you a little bit better terms and stuff like that.
For sure. There's a lot less side letters in those rounds because they're just not being asked for. And then you get some institutionals actually playing in the 500 to a million round size. And that's 8% to 10%. And then if you get to what we would call a seed on saves, you know, if you're raising $2.5-3 million on a safe round, that's a seed round. It's just being done on a different instrument. And there, it's actually good to see the math makes a lot of sense. Like safe rounds that are going off for $3 million, the founder is selling 19% or 20%, just as they would if it was a primary round that was being done on priced. They're just kind of just saving on the legal costs.
Right.
And maybe setting themselves up for a trickier conversation down the road, but we can leave that to one side.
Yeah, my favorite conversation is a founder that was raising on too high of a cap for their given traction. And I'm like, hey, very interesting. Everything looks good. Stay in touch when you get more traction.
Yeah.
And 9 to 12 months later, they come back and they're like, hey, we're reopening the safe at the same valuation. Guess what? It's still the 15 cap, but now we have triple the ARR. I'm like, see, I told you.
You're like, you nailed it.
Nailed it. And that, I come back in.
That's the weird part about the safe stuff is that it never, you never have to end it, right? It just can,
it's just kind of rolling out there. Yeah.
And it goes along and goes along, which is good in that you can always bring in capital, but bad in that I feel like people, if you're fundraising on a safe, it kind of feels like you're fundraising more often. Like you're always sort of.
It's kind of this perpetual party round. Totally. Right?
And it
just kind of becomes this like never ending, like rolling. I'm always raising for 3 or 4 years until I get to my Series A.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then you think you're saving on the legal cost, which you are versus a price, but then you get to the price and your lawyers are like, oof, we got a lot more work to do on this.
A lot of safes here. There's 58 safes on the cap table here. They all have different terms and conversion caps and discounts and side letters. And oh my gosh, this is going to be a nightmare.
So I get it. I get it, founders. It's good to raise on safes because it's easier, faster, rolling, all that stuff. But like having a good lawyer still matters. Like you're going
to
need one.
Yeah. And would you recommend that to founders out there? Like if they have the option to go priced in the seed, what are some pros and cons there that you see?
The pro is that you will clean the cap table up. You'll have all those conversions modeled out. And then you'll also go through due diligence in a really serious way, which maybe actually will be good for your business.
Yeah.
The cons are time and legal cost. So debating between those two. The other thing is that some investors have strong preferences on whether or not they do big safe rounds or they would rather you go to priced. I think it's sort of a personal choice, but I don't think that going to price is a bad option. Mm. And what I would say is that if you're getting to the third or fourth separate valuation cap, you should probably think about price next because it's just getting really complex. And you don't want to be caught unawares. The other thing to note is that people are using safes and convertible notes in between priced rounds now as bridges and extensions.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've started to see that. I never saw that before.
We hadn't seen very much of it before either, but
you're writing a safe. You already have a priced round and now you're raising another million, but you already have a cap table with priced shares, preferred shares, but you're doing a cap against the future round.
100%. And
it's weird. Yeah.
That cap by definition is not going to be negotiated in the same way as a priced round cap would be. So it's like gonna be wrong. It's going to be low or high. You don't know which, but it just feels like this is the easiest way for an insider on the cap table to bridge or extend this company. But to me, that is the place.
I stay away from those. Yeah, I stay away from those.
Like weird. At least use convertible notes, at least. But like,
why use a convertible note versus a safe?
Well, at least that convertible note comes with a maturity date with the interest rate. So it's like a forcing function to a future conversation.
Yeah.
But to me, it seems odd to use the safe in between priced. I think it's going to happen more and more as people... You know, people are talking seed extension, seed plus, mini Series A. Like, you know, the names are proliferating.
It's all seed all the way down. Like, it's all turtles all the way down.
Exactly. Lots of turtles.
Perpetual turtles.
Fundraising turtles, as we call them. Yep.
And since Carta has, you know, over 10 years of data on this stuff, how has the kind of the pre-Series A progressed in the last 10 years or evolved? And given that progression and kind of this post peak all-time environment, where do we see the trends going in the coming years for the pre-Series A?
you know, the pre-series A is attracting more capital than it used to. There's just a lot more funding that happens. It's one of the reasons why, if you look at the funding timelines, they've been extended out, not necessarily because it's taking that much longer in between a priced A and a priced B, but just that getting to the priced A in the first place is taking longer because you're bringing in funding on all these convertible instruments to begin with. And partly, I think that is responsible in some way, shape, or form for the extended period that companies are just staying private. You know, like a company on Carta that IPOs, I think the median over the last year was something like 10 years. It used to be like 8 or 9.
And it's that's from the priced round or from the founding of the company?
From the founding of the company, but okay, that's still, you know, and it'll get to 12, I would expect, before the end of 2020. Like, it's a long time that people are staying
private.
That's
a long time.
And that, I think it's underrated how much of a change that is to the way, especially liquidity works in the private markets. Like, if you're an employee and you're not going to have access to any of the value of this stock for a dozen years, it's a different calculus than 6 years. It's a very different thing. So that, I think, is the biggest change, is that all the pre-Series A funding extending out timelines and making liquidity a little bit more of a nebulous prospect for a lot of people that are involved.
Right. And there has been, you know, the rise of the secondary market, right? You know, Equity B, there's a bunch of others out there that, you know, they basically help people exercise and sell their shares. So there's been a little liquidity for employees. But what kind of changes would you like to see kind of in that private versus public market? Because it feels like it's here to stay. I feel like the private markets are open for business. They've extended IPO timelines. I mean, Amazon went public after 3 or 4 years.
Right. Yep.
Netscape was like 2 years. I think Google was 6. Facebook was 6 or something.
Yeah.
Just taking a lot longer. What do we need to do there to, I don't know, bolster it or make it more like transparent
It's definitely a valuable question to dig into, because if a lot more of the growth of the company is going to come before IPO, you want more people to have access to that growth, even if who would have been public market investors. And I guess there's a reasonable debate to say, like, you know, look at NVIDIA. There's a ton of growth left after you IPO if you're the right company.
Yeah,
but be that as it may, you know, some of that comes down to things like the accredited investor threshold, which, you know, back and forth on policymakers, whether or not that should be that you know, cap of however much you need to make in order to qualify as an accredited investor should be risen. Or should you use things like financial literacy tests or like CFAs and things to say, look, you may not have the capital, but you're a sophisticated quote unquote investor.
Yeah, don't we already have that with like the Series 65 or 66?
We do, but the discussion is like, do we raise that tier? And to me, it always felt weird that I can YOLO a bunch of money into the next crypto thing as quickly as I want to, but I can't invest in my buddy's startup. That seems odd.
That is weird. Yeah.
And so like, that seems weird. And then on the liquidity side, you know, there's a lot of different people that are thinking about private market liquidity. I don't think it's ever going to be, hey, log on to a Charles Schwab and trade in private stocks. Like that's just not going to happen based on the way the regulations work. But I think there will be more innovation in liquidity. I mean,
the government could step in and just say, hey, enough is enough. These companies are getting too big and destroying value.
Yeah.
Especially for, you know, big, you know, NGOs and foundations, endowments. And we've seen a lot of capital destruction.
Yep.
You know, especially from the peak. And, you know, maybe that wouldn't happen as much in the public markets under the scrutiny. And so maybe the government could step in and say, hey, after $1 billion or $5 billion, $10 billion, whatever the number is of value, you have to go public.
I bet they're thinking about it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have an opinion as to whether or not that's a good thing, but I don't think, I think I'd be
I don't
shocked.
Know if I'm for or against that, but I can see the government.
That wasn't a topic of discussion. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, is there a trigger where it's like, hey, there's too much value here.
Totally.
Yep. And it needs the kind of the public scrutiny to make sure you're not destroying value and burning out capital and screwing over employees because you gave them overpriced options that will never be in the money and all that stuff.
Right. The equity side, you know, Carta's equity database, I think, is pretty unparalleled, at least in the U.S. And one of the sad parts about the downturn gets a little less press than the shutdowns and things, but employees are exercising their equity at like record low rates. And some of that, a lot of that is just smart financial decision making. If you or I worked at a startup and we got laid off because that startup had a down round, how likely is it that we're going to exercise that equity? Probably not.
Exactly.
But it is sort of wrapped up in the promise of joining a startup is the upside in that equity. So like more education, more options for those people to exercise the equity, longer periods, like the 90 day. I know why it exists, because the ISO has the 90 day tax treatment, but it's, as a personal note, not speaking as a Carta here, I think it's super silly that most employees only have 90 days after they leave a company to make this decision. You know, Carta, it's actually indexed to how long you've been at the company. I think that's more reasonable, but even if that's not your approach, like there's things that we can change about the way equity works in startups that I think would have an impact on the upside liquidity value.
And I remember being a startup employee many, many times, getting all kinds of equity packages and just being completely in the dark on how should I value this? How much is this worth? What percentage of the company do I own? How much is 50,000 shares? Like, is that strike price good? What does that mean? And then, you left and now you have 90 days to cough up, you know, somewhere, you know, 5, 6, 7 figures of cash.
Totally.
To exercise. And that might be at a sky high valuation. That was 100x revenue because it was some AI company. Anthropic just raised at 180x, right?
Yep.
And if you're an Anthropic employee who just left, you're like, do I exercise?
What do I do?
Yeah. What is that fair for them? They're not sophisticated financial wizards to figure this stuff out.
I think that startup employees sometimes feel, I'll just use I terms here. I felt nervous asking those questions before I got to Carta. You know, I'd worked at startups and I was like, I guess I should probably already know this. Like, am I just being dumb and not understanding?
Yeah, I remember feeling the exact same way. Yeah.
That is like 100% untrue. Everybody at Carta asks these questions and we know more about it than anyone. So like people should ask the questions. They should, if you're negotiating an offer and you're joining a startup, if the startup that you're joining is only willing to give you the number of shares, that's not enough. That doesn't make any sense, right? You don't know the denominator. You don't know the ownership percentage. You don't know at what, one of my
favorite questions. What about the LICPREF? Stack.
The lick prep, the whole, like my favorite question to ask, if I was a startup employee listening to this and I was thinking about joining a new startup, the question that I would ask would be, what does the price per share need to be in order for common stock to make a profit?
Mm.
And what that does is it does two things. One, it forces the HR and recruiting people to know that number, which they may not. And two,
price here. Yeah.
Right. Because you need to take into account those that preferred has a different lick prep than common. Yeah. So you only will make money if the exit is good enough that it flows past the preferred threshold.
And that could be 2 or 3x your share price.
It might be 4x these days, you know, with the terms that people are signing. So I love that question as just a way to say, suss out, hey, is this company for real? Like, do they know how to talk to employees about the value of their equity? Because I sure as hell know when they're pitching me, they're talking about the upside of this equity. So they should be able to give me like, what are the real data on the upside here? And what does it mean for me to share in the value of this once we get acquired or IPO?
Yeah. And let's not forget too, that you're locked up as a common shareholder, an insider for 6 months after IPO.
Yes.
And in some cases after acquisitions as well, like you're beholden to the public markets. And I've had many friends from many different startups in Silicon Valley that, you know, thought they were worth $10, $20, $30 million on paper and then weren't. And it's pretty sad.
It's a tough pill to swallow when you are paper millionaire and then not. That's hard.
Yeah. So for why don't we kind of wrap up with a few rapid fires?
Let's do it.
Yeah. So what advice would you give early stage startups navigating the current funding environment?
Start fundraising earlier than you think you need to.
100%.
Secondly, your first contact with an investor should not be asking them for money. You should establish a relationship with the people that you think are going to be important to you. And I actually think one of the cool things we're seeing startups do is the ones who are taking it really seriously, they're taking a look at who they're going to need to invest in them at the seed or the A. And they may put them on their investor updates or get in touch with them early on and say, look, I know I'm not your target audience yet. Right. I'm too early, but I'm working towards you. And here's the progress that I'm making so that in 2 years, you come to that person and they say, oh, we've been following your progress for 2 years. Yeah. Of course, we'd love a conversation.
Well, there's also a cognitive bias at play, which is like a familiarity bias.
Yes.
Right. And I fall prey to this as an investor. You know, I'm like, oh, I've been getting your updates for 2 years and now you're ready to raise your seed round. Like, yeah, I'll take the call.
Right. Exactly. People wonder how to get warm intros. It's like, do it 2 years earlier than you need to. It's a lot easier that way. Yeah.
Right. And there's tools out there to find all the investors that are a fit for you on like NFX or, you know, PitchBook, Crunchbase, Carta, whatever. Get out there and find your people. Yeah. What kind of regulatory changes are you tracking that might influence startup funding?
I think we have a fantastic policy team at Carta that tracks all of this. We have a newsletter if people are interested in it. Mm. The one that keeps coming up when we talk to fund managers is actually the private fund advisor rule. Changes the reporting requirements for some early stage funds, some venture funds, some private equity funds. But there's always sort of a slight worry or skepticism that the SEC is going to come in and just kind of ruin the party on early stage startups. Mm. Or, I don't know if that's going to happen down to the level of the founder, but like fund managers should definitely be aware there may be changes coming with the SEC. And obviously we have an election, so who knows what's going to happen in the next year.
When should a startup take corporate venture capital, or do you guys track data around that and how effective that is for startups?
No, we haven't broken it out. I guess the common advice that I hear for corporate venture capital is that it is an effective way to pre-wire a potential acquisition. But the downside is there are people who don't love CVCs on the cap. And then there are also downsides in that the CVC might not care as much, or it's not as germane to the full corporate's business as to whether or not these individual investments work. You know, it's not the same as taking from a emerging manager who absolutely like the DPI that they get off these investments is how they're going to make their business work as if they stay in corporate or stay in venture capital overall. So different, a little bit of a different incentive structure
right. for CVCs. Yeah. I remember I was at Microsoft when they shifted M12 up. They used to be a financial investor.
Yep.
And they switched back to just being a strategic. You know, we're going to try to invest in solution areas that are aligned to Microsoft's know, strategic goals.
Exactly.
You know, kind of a Warren Buffett kind of question. Where do you see, I mean, there's obviously AI is overhyped. Are there any other things that are kind of overbid right now in the data versus maybe some value plays out there that investors should know about?
I don't generally want to prognosticate too much. AI is the category that grew the most last year. It will, I think, again, remain that top spot this year. The other, I think, cool things, I don't know if they're overbid, but we have seen slight rotations for away from bits and towards atoms. So things like robotics, hardware, biotech, real world things, you know, there's all the stories about El Segundo. Those are real. There's been like
what's the story about El Segundo? I don't know.
Oh, El Segundo.
The Tribe Called Quest song. I left my wallet there, but.
The Gundo, I guess, as Gundo. It's being called on Twitter. Just a collection of hardware, cool startups that are in the El Segundo region next to LA. They're in LA.
Nice. All right.
Cool folks. I think that that's a good thing. You know, people taking bets where the risk is not necessarily just executional, but like, can this even be done technically?
Yeah.
I think those are.
I'm really excited by robotics. I mean, you have so many companies like right on the cusp of releasing humanoid scale and level cognitively capable robotics. I mean, I think that's one of the trends coming in the next 5 to 10 years. It's going to really reshape our whole economy.
Totally. I think it's fascinating. The one other point that I'll make is, and this is a bit of a downer note, but there are certain categories for which venture capital is just not as much of an option anymore. And I'm thinking specifically of DTC retail. All of the Allbirds, Warby Parker, et cetera. Like, it is really difficult these days to get venture funding for a new beverage or a new, you know, a new line of apparel. It's not to say those businesses can't be fantastic businesses. They're just not really VC backable as much.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to say that, okay, yeah, we're gonna have this huge inventory cost.
Yes.
And it has what margin again? Okay, right. Great. And like, what's the return ratio? Yeah.
And how like, are you start squinting at it. Public market? Like, can you tell me about where they
are? Trading at 3x forward revenue? Like, exactly. Yeah, it gets hard to kind of squint. And, you know, I've heard, and I believe, you know, B2B SaaS and biotech are kind of the two best places to be a VC. And I don't know anything about biotech. So,
that means B2B SaaS. Yeah, there you go.
It's just B2B SaaS.
Have you seen that meme that goes, too late to explore the earth, too young to explore the stars, but just in time to sell B2B SaaS?
That's
really good. That's us. Yeah, we love it.
Yeah. Well, Peter, this is an amazing conversation. We'll have to have you back on the pod when the next big research report drops. Where can people get in touch and how should they learn more?
Absolutely. Yeah, this was fun, Brian. They can always find me on LinkedIn if you type in Peter Walker Carta. You'll find me there. And if you haven't, please join the Data Minute newsletter. It's about 20, 22,000 people now who get one chart a week out of our database about something interesting in startups. So
if
you found this conversation fun, you know, please sign up to that.
How do you sign up? How do you find the newsletter?
You can just type in Carta Data Minute into your search bar and it should pop up.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Peter. This was amazing.
Absolutely. My pleasure.